Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is part two of our weekly Q&A with Layla. This is an opportunity for you to send us your question, make it succinct and make it of general interest, and we'll answer it on the air during our weekly Q&A with Layla. If you send your question, it may take a week or two before it makes it on the air, so please keep listening to Q&A with Layla, because likely your question will be answered. Radioprogram at AOL.com is the place to send your questions. So what do we got for this hour, for this segment?
Okay. We've got an email from Joe. He says, I recently had an inguinal hernia lower chop repair with mesh. The healing is going well. All I've required for pain is Advil. What would you advise to prevent any future hernias in this area other than heavy lifting, which is what caused this one?
Right.
Any specific exercises I should be doing once it's healed up to prevent the chops from future pops?
Huh. That's good. He wrote that?
Yeah.
He's fun. He's funny. Yeah.
He's also taking now zinc picolinate along with L-carnosine since the surgery. He's taking krill oil, too. I would also recommend bromelain, right?
Yeah. Well, I'd probably also drink a teaspoon of Elmer's glue every day, because that will, you know, get right into that area and just really make it hold. Maybe some Gorilla Glue or something like that. No, listen, I got to say, this, I think, is more of a structural problem than a nutritional problem. It's true that, you know, poor nutrition, your muscles, your connective tissues, your sinews tend to deteriorate, to degenerate. However, I cannot say that any single vitamin or even, you know, some hyaluronic acid or collagen extract is going to make that area stronger. So, you know, with the mesh in place, you know, I think it's, you know, it's a matter of, was the surgery good? Was the mesh strong? And are you going to avoid placing unreasonable demands on the surgical site? Actually, usually the surgical site is stronger than the other side. It, you know, typically people don't tear on the side that's been repaired. They tear on the opposite side because, you know, they've got super mesh in their groin, and that's less likely to tear and separate. So, you know, it's a bad problem, and we've had problems with the mesh in the past. I think they've worked that out, but there's actually lots of lawsuits about faulty mesh, mesh that has created problems, that's become inflamed, in some cases infected, migrated.
I heard that about the vaginal mesh?
Same mesh. Same
collapse.
Mesh. Yeah, they used the same mesh, and there was a big mess. And, you know, there are actually surgeons who specialize not in the initial surgery, but in the corrective surgery, because you know, once that, it's actually easier to do the initial surgery than to take out the bad mesh and clean up the area and then repair. So, okay, fortunately, we're not dealing with that kind of situation. Hernia is a mechanical problem. It's a little bit like, I think, again, the analogy here would be like to ask, you know, call in on an automotive show and say, you know, I've got faulty suspension in my car. You know, my shock absorbers aren't working. What additive can I add to my gasoline, to my motor oil, to make my suspension work better? And the answer is, it's the suspension, you know, and you can't, there's nothing you can put into your car externally to make your suspension work better. You got to replace your shocks, you know, very plainly.
No specific exercises then either, huh?
There might be some physical therapy exercises, although I think it's just a matter of, you know, regaining some degree of flexibility, being cautious at first, nursing it along. And, you know, fortunately, there's a lot of nerves in that area, and you can get a foreign body sensation or chronic, you know, mild aches and pains that take a long time to subside. It's a tough kind of situation.
Best of luck to Joe. I hope you're healing well.
That's something that, you know, thank God I haven't had to, you know, very common in men. And as I roll into my 60s, that's fortunately not something that I've had to contend with, in spite of the fact that I do a lot of running and lifting and, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Our next question comes from Rachel. She's concerned about the estrogenic effects of milk thistle. This is what she writes. I tried milk thistle for a mild fatty liver, but had to stop after 3 days because of horrible anxiety and palpitations. After Googling my symptoms, I got several sites that say this herb, as well as some others, mimic estrogen. I most likely have estrogen dominance as well, so I guess I'll try something else. Any suggestions?
Well, that's a very thoughtful evaluation. I mean, this is a person who should be sitting behind the desk when we confront some of our challenging patients, because that's a thoughtful analysis of why a very unexpected symptom might arise in regard to milk thistle. However, I personally don't characterize milk thistle as a particularly estrogenic herb. We utilize milk thistle in many of our patients, even patients who've had a history of breast cancer or perhaps uterine cancer, without a consideration that they might be at risk of having an estrogenic effect. And in fact, intuitively, I would say it should have the opposite effect, and I'll tell you why. Patients who have estrogen dominance, that means too much estrogen buildup in the body, often they have inefficient liver function. And because they have inefficient liver function, they don't break down the estrogen that is produced by their ovaries and by their fat cells sufficiently, and estrogen builds up. So anything that would help the liver to work better is more likely to reduce your estrogen levels. I mean, not to the point where you get osteoporosis or symptoms of menopause by too quickly reducing it, but somewhat reducing it into the normal helpful range. So I can't quite account for that. I'm not sure what is going on with this person.
Yeah. You know what else is interesting? I've never heard of anyone suffering from anxiety or palpitations from milk thistle.
I'm not discounting it.
Here's
a problem with many conventional doctors is they will look up a side effect of a drug, and if they don't find it among the top or major side effects of the drug, they assume that the patient is imagining it. And I have come to recognize that there are two types of side effects people can have with drugs or supplements. One are the predictable ones occur in a lot of people. And then there are the unpredictable or idiosyncratic ones. And yes, it's possible that it's a coincidence that her anxiety arose when she took that. And usually what we say is, why don't you retry it? Just make sure that each and every time you try it, indeed you get that side effect. It's not like a life-threatening side effect. It's bothersome, but it's worth retrying. Because there, it could be a coincidence. Because anxiety does, sometimes it arises and dispels on its own without an outside influence. What we do see, though, is we see weird paradoxical side effects. We see, patients who take theanine, which should be relaxing, feeling wired or stimulated. I mean, there are some people whose systems seem to be backwards. They're what are called paradoxical reactors. A paradoxical reaction, which is like, you expect it. Oh, it's going to be like, or people take melatonin. Oh, my goodness, I was wide awake. I was awake all night. it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. Well, sorry about that. You're a paradoxical reactor.
Yeah. Well, Rachel is special.
Yes. Well, Rachel sounds like a lot of our patients, highly sensitive and very attuned to, it's kind of like Murphy's Law. If it can go wrong, it'll go wrong in a patient like that.
Yeah.
Whatever can go wrong will go wrong.
I would advise Rachel to get a checkup, a workup for her mild fatty liver. That's something that should be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot more for mild fatty liver, like NAC, N-acetylcysteine, alpha-lipoic acid.
I did a whole clinical focus on fatty liver disease.
Terrific. Rachel should listen to that.
Yeah, that's if you go back a couple of months, you have to scroll down through our podcast list. One of the things that we're doing to enhance our website is we're enhancing the search feature on our podcast, so it'll be more easy to find podcasts, because let's say a podcast that I did 2 years ago addresses your problem. Well, you'd have to scroll down through quite a few podcasts to find it, and we're going to display it all on one page so that you can see if your condition is matched by a podcast that I've done. That'll be coming up in 2015. We've been brainstorming, and we're constantly thinking of ways that we can upgrade drhoffman.com to make the information more convenient and accessible for you.
Okay. The next question is from Marianne. Dear Dr. Hoffman, would the grapefruit diet, which you mentioned reduced weight gain in mice fed a high-fat diet by 18%, be able to be incorporated into a grain-brain style of eating? If someone is low carb or even mildly in ketosis, would this be effective for weight loss? It was interesting that the story followed the anti-sugar story on your show. How would grapefruit or grapefruit juice even be a healthy recommendation because of the sugar content?
Exactly.
Thank you so much.
So, you know, I recognize by throwing out bits and pieces of information that sometimes the information can appear to clash or be contradictory. On the one hand, we say improve your brain with an ultra-low carb diet. And then, you know, fast forward to a story that shows that if you drink grapefruit juice, it can enhance your metabolism and help you lose your weight. However, grapefruit juice is, you know, even though it's rather tart, it still is a source of some carbohydrate calories and sugars. So how do you reconcile those? And, you know, the answer is, you know, it is difficult to reconcile those, I think. You know, if you really are committed to a ketogenic diet and you want to put yourself into ketosis, you can't drink grapefruit juice.
Right?
But
you could probably eat half a medium-sized grapefruit. It's only about 9 to 10 grams of carbs.
Okay.
As long as you factor that into the rest of the carbs of the day.
You worked at Atkins, mm-hmm. and you go way back, you worked with the late, great Dr. Robert Atkins. Would he have allowed grapefruit juice for somebody trying to lose weight?
Not juice, no.
Okay.
And fruit is not in phase one of the diet. There's no fruit. That comes actually a little later in the form of either berries, which are the lowest in sugar, as well as grapefruit, provided the person is not on medication where grapefruit would interfere.
So it would be on the maintenance phase of the diet, right?
Yeah, probably closer to phase two and three.
Okay.
Where it would actually work. You know, a half a medium-sized grapefruit, not those big mammoth-sized grapefruits. When I say a medium-sized grapefruit, that's the size of kind of a large orange.
Uh-huh.
That's what I mean by a medium-sized grapefruit, a large orange. Half of that would be about 9 or 10 grams.
Maybe they can do some research and extract that part of the grapefruit that's responsible for the weight loss and turn it into a magic weight loss supplement. Maybe they can come up with that. I'm sure that's on the drawing boards, because once those scientists start experimenting with mice, the next is they're going to come up with a magic pill and a patent application, and we're off to the marketplace.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I can see it. I can see it coming.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is that grapefruit does to enhance metabolism and then accelerate weight loss, if it applies to humans. By the way, you know, we've cured so many diseases in mice. You know, we've cured spinal injuries in, you know, in mice. We have models where we can make mice where we sever their spine, we can get them to walk again.
Uh-huh.
However, it doesn't work in people yet. But you know, we've cured you know, all manner of diseases with things in
with
mice,
rodents.
And you know, I kind of love these experiments where they give rodents a high fat diet. You know, and then they use something to counteract the effects of the high fat diet.
Yeah,
like because that's what the grapefruit thing was. Well,
exactly.
Rodents don't eat a high fat diet in the wild. You know, it's like, when was the last time you saw a rat, you know, in New York City subways with a steak in its
exactly.
in its mouth?
They just eat garbage.
They eat just, and well, they virtually anything, but mostly they eat. In the wild, they eat, you know, grainy type stuff, you know, like mouse food, rat food is grains.
Yeah. And so that's not their native diet anyway.
Right.
So even, you know, it's not a good measure, in other words.
That cheese thing? Yeah, I don't know about cheese. You know, when I used to put out mouse traps, you know, when I used to have, you know, I've been through some tough times. I used to have mice in my apartment I was a young struggling medical student. I lived in a small apartment in Greenwich Village, and you know, there were mice, and you know, we put out mouse traps, and we'd use peanut butter. They go for peanut butter. I might be part rodent if that's the case, because if you could catch me in a mouse trap with peanut butter. Absolutely. I would go there.
Okay. Oh, so Marianne, feel free to have a half a medium grapefruit from time to time. I don't see it as a problem on a ketogenic diet.
Thank you.
So,
okay, so dilemma solved.
Dilemma solved, hopefully,
right.
For Marianne.
Okay.
We've got a couple of questions here. Okay, all right. There's still the controversy or the dilemma, Dr. Hoffman, about when to take probiotics empty stomach or full stomach, and particularly Dr. O'Hara's probiotic.
I know. Here it comes again.
What's the verdict?
I know. And Dr. O'Hara's probiotic says, it says take it away from food, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I've talked to the people at Dr. O'Hara, and they say, well, you know, their studies do show that it may be damaged by the production of hydrochloric acid in the stomach that is induced by a meal. So, therefore, taking away from food may obviate the damage. However, what goes against that is that if you take, say, fermented cabbage, also known as, you know, natural
sauerkraut.
Unpasteurized sauerkraut or kimchi, and you take it in the context of the meal, even when you take it with other food, those beneficial bacteria still make their way into your gastrointestinal tract. So, you know, I rest my case. I think that it could be argued both ways. I don't think I'm going to stick to my guns. I've said this again and again. I think that timing is less crucial in the administration of probiotics. And there actually are some probiotics that are in what is called, they're enterically coated so that they break down lower in the intestinal tract. And, you know, that's a good idea, but I'm not sure that it renders them superior or more efficacious than other probiotics, which are not similarly enterically coated.
Right. Okay. So, that should be that. Next question. All right. This comes from Ramona. Dr. Hoffman, thank you first for being you. My son, 21.
that's a funny comment. Nice. Okay.
My son, 21, was recently diagnosed with hemochromatosis, fatty liver, high LDL, elevated liver enzymes. He's about 60 pounds overweight.
Oh, boy.
Does your practice treat this condition?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, we do.
Yes, it does. So here's double trouble. I mean, I think you know the answer to this, too, is there's two ways, I mean, many ways to mess up your liver, but two ways to mess up your liver. One is being overweight and having a high LDL, which implies that you are much more likely to have fatty liver. And that, on top of it, a genetic predisposition to iron overload, which is very harmful to the liver. In fact, people who have iron overload or hemochromatosis are at risk of liver failure and the need for liver transplant. They develop severe damage to their liver because excess iron is very damaging to the organs. And the first organ that it seems to hit is the liver. So this is, you know, you got to treat this on the one hand medically. And how do you treat it medically?
Yeah.
You draw the blood. You draw the blood out so that you actually pull iron out of the body. That's the medical part of the treatment for hemochromatosis. But the other aspect of it is that you avoid excess stress on the liver by utilizing nutrients that preserve the liver, and milk thistle is one of them, the aforementioned milk thistle that we talked about earlier, but other nutrients. But also getting a patient on, well, why don't you take it from here? What type of diet is going to be beneficial for fatty liver condition?
Oh, for fatty liver, definitely we need to lower the carbohydrates so the person can lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly one thing. Exercise is included. Help for liver is N-acetylcysteine, alpha-lipoic acid, phosphatidylcholine. These are very, very beneficial for the liver.
Betaine, trimethylglycine. Even SAMe could be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
SAMe has also been shown to be helpful for liver
SAMe
problems.
SAMe is good, yeah.
Anti-inflammatory, curcumin could also be helpful. Even some studies suggest that green tea, although there are some studies that show that very high concentrations of EGCG may be damaging the liver, I actually think that drinking a little green tea might be beneficial. Oh, by the way, tea actually depletes iron. That's one of the ways you can interfere with iron. Yeah.
Yes. Matter of fact, with your meals, having a cup of tea, like, it would be beneficial to block the iron absorption. Excellent idea.
Study was done. How they discovered this, I don't know if you know the origin of this, but they did a study in Israel where one of the in Israel there are a lot of people of Eastern European origins, you know, Russian Jews who came to Israel and settled. So they brought with them the habit of drinking tea. My grandparents were Polish, and there was nothing that my grandfather liked more than a nice glass tea. It had to be in a glass, and he would actually put crystal sugar into it with lemon. That was his idea.
Very European, yes.
Right? So it's really like a Polish thing. And, you know, it was the crystal sugar was on a little piece of string. He dissolved it in there. And it's just guzzled tea. So what they discovered in Israel is they, for some reason they got the idea that, you know, you got to give the baby something. So what are you going to give the baby, you know, after you know after the milk, so the baby has something in the bottle? They would have the babies drinking tea from the bottle. Well, what they found was it caused iron deficiency in the children because they malabsorbed iron from all that tea they were drinking.
Yeah. And, you know, children are already at risk for being iron poor.
Yes, yes.
So, wow, okay. Yeah.
So, but in this case, we can turn the tea drinking into our favor. But, you know, look, I mean, it sounds like this is a kid, probably a young adult or maybe a middle-aged adult, who is in trouble and really needs not just the medical treatment for hemochromatosis, but a complementary medicine or integrated medicine dietary perspective on this, because you know, already the liver has been damaged by the excess iron, and that excess weight and the fatty liver is going to accelerate the progression towards liver failure and the need for a transplant. You know, the number one reason for liver transplants in this country is not chronic hepatitis, it's not alcoholism, it's fatty liver. It's fatty liver.
Wow. It's fatty liver.
Fatty, which is dietary. I mean, a lot of people think, oh,
it's
like
completely a lifestyle disease.
Yeah. I mean, who gets, you know, whose livers fail? Who, you know, it's like these celebrities, rock stars, you know, they mess up their livers, they drink too much. But actually, it's, just the regular citizen who overconsumes carbohydrates. In particular, fructose is very bad. Fructose
terrible.
From soda
it
goes right to
triglycerides right. Like nothing else.
Goes
probably.
Right to the liver and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Resist. The high triglycerides, that's fat being churned out by the liver and causing the liver to become fatty.
Yep.
So, yeah, fructose is one of the worst. Okay. That's why don't drink your fruit juice.
Right. Do we have a really short one, or can we...
We have a related one, actually, Dr.
Okay, Hoffman, good.
From
okay.
Patricia, more about hemochromatosis.
Wow.
She says, on today's show, you had a caller who spoke about hemochromatosis. You mentioned that a high level of ferritin was not good. My ferritin's always been high. My last test last month had a ferritin of 244. Should I worry?
That's
Do
high.
I have hemochromatosis? I'm right. 77.
Okay. So that's high. But this is a
maybe
she.
Maybe not for a 77-year-old.
Well, this is a she, number one.
Yeah.
And if this is occurring at 77, this is probably not a classic case of hemochromatosis, because people have very high ferritins that are in the four digits, you know, 1,200 or more early on in life. And there's a male predominance of hemochromatosis. And do you know why?
Wow. Why? Lack of menstruation.
Thank you. Yeah, is that one of the women get rid of blood, you know, pretty efficiently on a monthly basis until they reach 50. Then they become, in essence, like men, and they can overaccumulate iron. So women who carry hemochromatosis gene may not get into trouble until postmenopausal years. That means they have 30 or so less years to develop hemochromatosis, usually hemochromatosis less severe in women. The other thing about a high ferritin, it has to be investigated. It can occur in certain inflammatory conditions because high ferritin could be a marker of excess iron, but it could also be a marker of some kind of chronic inflammatory disorder that artificially raises. It's called an acute phase reactant, and it reacts it's a protein that amplifies in the face of some kind of inflammatory condition. So it might be a false positive, it might be a true positive. At 77, what are you going to do? Is it necessary to give blood or draw off blood? That would be for hematologists to determine. And there is a genetic test for hemochromatosis. There actually is a specific genetic test to tell you if you have it. But the guidelines are different for women than men. Men who have the genetic, and there are various forms. Some are more severe than others. You can actually determine that from the gene assortment on the gene test. And the management of hemochromatosis depends on your age, your sex, and the genetic type that you have, and of course your ferritin and your iron scores. And then and another thing that you might do is you might do a liver biopsy to see if indeed this is affecting the liver and creating problems.
Yeah.
The liver biopsy is quite, the appearance of the cells that they pull out is quite distinct. It looks like it's all laden with iron. If you use an iron-sensitive stain, you'll see massive amounts of iron crowding out the liver cells.
Oh, scary.
Yep.
And Patricia should not be taking any supplement containing iron. And a lot of multivitamins contain iron. she should be sure to get a multi if she's taking a multi that doesn't have any iron in it, like our foundation formula.
Our foundation for it doesn't have iron, in fact. Yeah.
Right.
Right, intentionally right. So a corollary question is, can you combat hemochromatosis with diet?
I don't know.
Well, you know, I think the answer is that's a correct answer, because it depends on the extent. I mean, you can forestall it, perhaps, to some extent with a very low iron diet. Say, you know, get on a vegetarian diet and avoid iron-rich vegetables. But it would not be advisable for someone to consume lots of red meat, perhaps, under those circumstances, because that might accelerate the accumulation of iron.
Unless they drink some tea with it or something, but still, the avoidance of red meat is preferred.
Right, but still, you know, the iron retaining mechanism is so efficient that you still have to either, you know, give blood, get blood tapped off out of you. You know, this is an illustration of, you know, the expression, even a broken clock is right twice a day.
Yeah.
You know, they had this ancient medical practice of bleeding people, you know, for whatever ails you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you're sick, you know, let's put the leeches on, there's a medical journal called The Lancet. It was called The Lancet because they used to use lancets to bleed people. That's how ancient that practice is. And in fact, you didn't go to a doctor, you went to a barber who was also a doctor. You know, because why was a barber a doctor? Because they had sharp tools. they could cut hair, and they could also bleed you. So this is an ancient, very ancient practice, you know, goes way back in the medieval times and before. And sometimes, you know, they got it right. If indeed the person had an iron overload, that was the right treatment. But the vast majority of people were rendered anemic and weak and, you know, ultimately succumbed to the bleeding. That's actually one of the things that did in George Washington. He probably had, historically we don't know what he had, but we think that he may have had congestive heart failure. And, you know, he was all getting bloated and swollen. And they bled him. And, of course, that's not the right treatment for congestive heart failure. And that seemed to hasten his demise. And, you know, instead of, you know, they didn't have diuretics in those days and ways to get the excess fluid off. So they bled him. And that probably led to his more rapid death.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you know, we've got the best doctors attended him. In fact, some of the doctors who were signers of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush was in attendance. And, you know, as much as they're pretty sophisticated about establishing a new democratic republic, they had no clue as to how to treat people in those days.
Wow.
So you're better off. You're probably better off being poor and not being, you know, a celebrity and having all those doctors running to your bedside with their eager to draw your blood off.
Mm. Wow. Anyway, I hope that answers Patricia's question.
So much for the history of medicine. All right, so great. That's all the time we have for today's edition of Q&A with Layla. And, you know, I started to realize, I think, why people really enjoy this segment, because you never know what we're going to get.
Uh-huh.
And the conversation is usually candid and unscripted. And it gives people an opportunity to kind of peek behind the curtain, look behind the scenes, and explore how we mutually tackle medical problem solving, and so that's I think part of the appeal of Q&A with Layla.
I'm glad people are enjoying it. Wonderful.
Indeed, they are. According to stats, you know, as I mentioned on a previous podcast, 9 out of 10 top podcasts, most listened to podcasts, are Q&A with Layla. So that's pretty good.
That's terrific.
So
that's great.
Well, I think today was another great example of that. All right, thanks very much for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thank you, Layla. And this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.